Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
So what happened for me was I became successful early on because I was in a position to succeed. And so I ran with opportunities in continuing education and a practice. And then ultimately what got me to this point was I knew what I wanted. And so it goes back to meeting you, honestly. I came up to you at Voices Dentistry and said, "Hey, I'm Sully. What you do is, you know, has impacted me in a very positive way, and okay, I want to be a part of that."
So what I wanted to hear is that ultimately, if you have a goal or a dream, what you want to do is just get out there and ask somebody or introduce yourself to somebody, right? It's called mentoring, right? Ask to get mentored. Would you guys all agree that nobody volunteers to mentor you, that you ultimately, if you want to be mentored, you asked to get mentored? Right. In other words, you got to go out and seek people out that you want to be like and do that. So ultimately, would you guys agree? So Mina, you're relatively younger dentist. Aaron, you're relatively, no, not really. Okay. Okay. And John, you're relatively younger dentist. Would you say that you reach some of the places you're going not by waiting for people to come to you, but by creating these opportunities?
What I think is interesting is that we're in a position as young dentists with technology and the resources we have at our fingertips to, we can achieve a lot more earlier on. And so if we would take advantage of the things we have at our fingertips, we can do that. What kills me is when we sit back and wait for it to come to us. We don't want to go out and meet people. We don't want to have those relationships. We want to do that to where we just want to like be online and like learn from that point of view, because that's not where it's going to like make us better.
Why do you think that is?
Just because that's how we've kind of grown up to a degree. I mean, I think ultimately we've grown up in an age where like communication became less from a social, like a interaction standpoint.
So let me ask you this, Sully. So, and look, I'm not trying to say that you're the greatest but
I'm pretty cool.
Yep, you're pretty cool. And for somebody 2 years and 2 months out of school, you've kind of put yourself in positions to possibly do some great things. So to me, a lot of this also comes from not just doing online learning.
Right.
So to me, this is an example of the negative of just online learning is you don't have that interaction. Now, for example, let me give you an example. So our goal here was today to come talk about our secondary career outside of dentistry and how to build that and do some impact. But I would also argue that some of the most enlightening stuff for you was that time with Benji, just randomly talking, correct? Him sharing something different with you. That would have never, ever happened in an online venue. No chance. Okay, and that ability to mingle and meet others and talk to others, those things just don't happen in an online venue. And for me, I get that your generation is very technologically oriented, but my fear is that we're going to rely on technology for all our education in the sense of online learning and really miss that social impact, that social, you know, camaraderie, and that ability to learn something that we unexpectedly learned from somebody else that happens to be in the audience where we're at.
Well, I think learning online is very linear in a way that like you learn something because you like you listen to it and see it and you can implement it, and that's fine. But like to your point about the extenuating conversations that happened this weekend outside of what our plan was, it's like exponential, right?
We
like,
had really not much of a plan.
Yeah, it's true. But that's ultimately what created this environment of like it was an exponential learning experience for most of us. I mean, we're coming away from this like when we're trying to. And Mina and I are completely redoing it the way we've run a lot of our team starting Monday morning. I mean, it's been eye opening in many more ways than just, you know, what it looks like outside of our dental careers, but just because we're interacting with people on a different level.
John, what's up, dude?
You're kind of like a tweener. Because you like you are totally a tweener. You don't claim the millennial tag, but you are kind of millennial. And you kind of like to be, cooler than you are. So you act way older than you are.
John, you got to put the mic a little closer to you.
33.
And you act way cooler than you are.
What do you mean?
I mean, like what I'm saying, like you don't want to be associated with me as a millennial.
No, I don't want to be associated with you as you. I think that's fair.
That's truth. Okay, I'll give you that.
John, so talk to me. Your passion is helping dentists become multiple practice owners.
Yes. Yep.
So what is the challenge that most dentists face? Do you think, let me ask you this, okay? Even though this is the Millennial Dentist Podcast and I'm going to take over, which is what I do. I would say that what I'm seeing is that the vast majority of people who are trying multiple practice are the millennial generation. They're the 35 and under group versus my generation, the 40, 45 plus group.
Yep.
Would you guys agree? Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that. So here's the deal. People of my generation and Sully's generation, we're sitting here in a position where we are much more at will to take risks. And by risks, I mean serious risk. So somebody in your generation.
Because
somebody,
you can go back and live in your mom's basement?
No, absolutely not.
That's a bunch of bull crap. Can we stop talking about that? Like, that's such a bull.
No.
We're the generation that's freaking going to kick your ass. You know it. And like, your generation is the one that's doing billions and crowns and not pushing it. So
Sully.
Just suck it. Like, that's what your people are doing, right? Your people aren't buying shit.
Okay.
your age, but.
Okay.
Wow. That derailed me.
Sorry.
Anyhow.
It's a fact, though.
Tarun, people, dentists that are around your age, dentists that are around your state in their career.
Mid to late 50s.
I'm 41.
41, early, mid 40s dentists are much more risk adverse. And I totally.
Because we have a lot to lose.
I totally understand that. Because if I was at that point in my career where I've reached the middle of my career, I'm not creating something, I'm building it now. So I've already created what I have. I'm now building it up so that I can prepare to tail off. You're at that building stage. And at this point in your career, it doesn't make a lot of sense to make these crazy risks of buying 2, 3, 4, 5 practices with multiple associates, all these issues to worry about when you finally have figured out what works for you.
What are the pitfalls of owning multiple practices?
The pitfalls are, there's too many for us to really get into right here, but the number 2 or 3. All right. So first of all, there's the stress level. This is a significant stress, not only on your professional life, but your personal life, your financial situation. You're now not worried about 6 or 7 mouths to feed, including your own. You're now worried about 20, 30, 40 employees, plus their family, plus their kids. Things get really, really serious very quickly, and that's a significant stress. And then number two, there's also the security that you have. So whether you're my generation, Tarun's generation, somebody that's getting ready for a retirement generation, putting yourself at risk like that is a really scary thing. And the only people in my mind that are really prepared for it are people that are younger, that don't have anything to risk, they have nothing to put at stake, or the older generation that they're already set for the next stage in their life and they've got some fun money that they just want to throw at it and see what they can do and have fun with it. But those are the two things to me. It's the stress and the risk of your security in the future.
Would you say, what percentage of dentists do you think are cut out for multiple practice ownership?
I think
it's a big buzzword right now in dentistry.
From what I've encountered, this is just my experience, me personally. There's probably 20 to 30% of the dentists my age and younger that think that this is something that they want to do, should do, can do. It's at least 30%. And of that, there's maybe 10% of them that are actually prepared for it. It's a very, very small percentage.
And ultimately, the goal of multiple practice ownership is what?
So the goal of multiple practice ownership is twofold. So we're going to reach a point where there's a fork in the road and you have to make a decision. So building your multiple practice group and you have to make the call. Are you comfortable with the idea of turning over this thing, this enterprise, this business, your baby, your child over to some investment group? And for a number of us, that's completely acceptable. We're okay with that. We're on board with that. We're trying to build a business. We're trying to monetize it. We're trying to provide good care along the way. And that's the number one goal. But if we have this asset that is worth something to someone else, we're totally comfortable in turning that over and creating some wealth for ourselves. Now, at the same time, as you're growing towards that, you may realize that this wealth isn't attainable, or maybe it's not even important to you. And at that point, you have a great situation because you have a good business that you've created in your vision, your way of doing things, that suddenly is creating a lot of ongoing cash flow for yourself, which is good from a business perspective because you can pay all of your employees. But number two, it's great from a personal perspective because maybe now you can step back from dentistry a little bit. You can concentrate on the things that are your passions. You can concentrate on sleep. If you love ortho, you can do nothing but ortho cases for patients that otherwise might not be able to get it. You can help others with business development.
But I do think you're fantasizing this a little bit for us, though. Like, we're getting a little excited about it, though. Because I mean, what...
You know me. I get excited.
You do get excited.
I get excited.
What are the... I mean, it's not all sugar plums and roses, though.
No. So,
if it's so easy, why wouldn't everyone do it?
If it were
why
so easy...
like myself or someone like Mina or someone, you know, even people much smarter than us. Not that there's many people much smarter
You know what,
than
though?
Us.
I would say people like you and people like Mina are both more than capable of doing something like this. You both are smarter than me.
That's true. We're definitely
more
talented.
You both are smarter than me. I can promise you.
I'm definitely not willing to risk.
You
I'm not willing to risk everything.
Are smarter than me. And you're probably both better in your practices than me.
I don't think it's a risk issue for me. I think there's...
A little bit closer to your mouth.
I think there's a better way to do it. And I think having multiple locations and redundant overhead... You know, you're going to have rent and a lease in every building. You're going to have redundant staff in every building. I think it, for me, at least my vision is more of a large mega practice that has every specialty under one roof served by several general dentists where you have all the control in the practice and you're still treating the same number of people.
And Mina, I can tell you from a cash flow perspective, your idea makes way more sense and it's much more attainable. And it's something
on a short term basis. Like, you know, you're not going to get the multipliers you're getting, though.
Sure. No. But not,
why?
No.
So?
So let me ask a question about that. Okay. So ultimately, I think maybe there's some misleading. I think there's a lot of ego involved in multiple practice ownership.
Okay.
And ultimately, I think the game is simple. Okay. It's a game of revenue. Correct. Okay. Who cares if you have 10 practices and you produce $10 million? To me, it's worth the same as one practice that produces $10 million.
I would say the one practice that produces $10 million is worth more than 10 practices that produce $1 million.
Okay, so then here's my question to the listeners and to each of you. Then why are more practices not focused on being smarter in their one location and so many people are chasing? Like, I know people that are chasing multiple practices that are literally making very little money in each practice, but it's the allure of having 10, 15, 20 practices to sell. When I'm like, dude, just open one practice like Mina's saying and just bring in people to do different things that you can't do so you can take care of patients from beginning to end.
But I think you answered the question in your own statement. You said, why would you do that? Because it's smarter to do one practice and build it up, right? So honestly, if you're not that smart and you're a mediocre dentist and you could quickly put up an $800,000 or $1 million practice, you might not know how to do $5 million, but you might know how to do $5 1 millions. And so you answered it. If you just don't have the certain skills, might be better.
I'm not willing to take the risk. And I think there's a little ego in not owning multiple locations because I feel like no one can take care of my patients or other patients like I can. So I think there's could be a little ego on both sides.
I agree. But I think ultimately, Mina, let's talk back about that. So I had you on the T-Bone Speaks podcast. So you millennials, when you're looking for a real podcast, can come on the T-Bone Speaks podcast.
Whoa.
I'm going to put a sign up on your podcast like you put a sign up at my seminar, okay?
Look, you know what? If they want to know what worked for a while, for a couple of years, they should listen to your podcast. But
that's
the future
correct.
Is here.
So, Mina, your concept is bringing specialists into the office, correct?
Correct.
So talk about that.
So I think there's a disconnect in the traditional model where patients are treated in a general dental practice and then referred to a specialist office.
Shuffled around.
Patient leaves, goes to a different location, has to be reintroduced to a new team, new faces, new everything. And it's, I think it hurts case acceptance and it hurts the overall outcome. So I think the model now, and if I was a specialist, this is what I would do. I would travel around to different general practices and provide my services there under
their
roof.
What's in for a specialist to do that?
It's less overhead, less headache. You don't have to worry about rent and staffing and...
So let's talk about this.
Mina, what would we pay a specialist in this situation? What's the
35%, 40%?
No, 40 to 50%.
I think 40 to 50%. 50%.
In my
gets paid 40% when it comes to
oral. I would pay 50% for a specialist, like an oral surgeon, endodontist, periodontist.
Very well, sutures cost a lot of money.
Depending on the procedure, but very little, typically. Third molars.
He's only allowed to place silk sutures in my office.
From a roll.
Yeah. From a roll. No, I think...
Okay, so,
So what was interesting is because this touches on this whole specialist idea and bringing in and patients wanting. I 100% agree with you because I think the new model is that because
Let's not say the new model. The future model is that.
It's a good point. The future model because what we found very early on. Utan, do you want to say something?
Well, I was gonna say. I mean, because you guys all know, I grew up in LA. We were doing that back in like 2007-08. Not necessarily because we were smart and that's what we thought was the future.
We had to.
We could not literally survive without our friends who are endodontists, oral surgeons coming in and banging out certain cases because if left the office, literally financially, we wouldn't be able to survive. So it was out of a necessity a decade ago.
When I graduated and went with him with dad, you know, who's my associate, it was out of necessity that we grow the practice. And we've all talked about like my practice in 2 years has grown by like 60 active patients, but we're doing $1 million more in dentistry. So how do we do that? Well, we build the procedures we do more dentistry. So to that, because what happens is you realize patients don't want to go other places. Like they like knowing where to park. They like Susie Q up front that she
Why
does
it have
the front
to be Susie
desk.
Q? Why can't it be Bob Q?
It can be Bob Q. It can be Joe from, cause her accent is really,
can it be Tim?
Really sick. It can be, hey, good baby.
Hey,
good baby.
Real quick, who has a male employee other than a dentist here? Anyone? Male employee.
I have an intern that's a male.
I have a male front desk right now. It's freaking awesome.
Nice.
It's amazing. Not afraid to have
what happened to Pitard?
Any conversation with any patient. It's pretty awesome. It's a very, you know what? Dentistry is a very sexist field because other than dentists, how many males are there in dentistry?
Other than dentists, by the way, 52% of graduating dentists are female.
Hey, so now we are the minority. But what
dentistry being told?
So as we're graduating now, we're not the minority yet.
But forgetting dentists, what percentage of dental professionals do you think are male?
Well, 40%. You're getting us way off track, though.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So, Mina, back
to Mina because this is.
How'd you bring it in? How'd you find somebody?
You have to find the right person. It has to be someone. Dentists are programmed to live in an island. I want my own office, my own team. Specialists are the same way. I want to live off of referrals, and this is how I survive. So you have to find the right person who's willing to be flexible enough to work in a different office. You know, I'm not his only office. He's in several offices, and he travels around, and he comes to me, you know, 2 to 3 times a month. So he's got to be flexible enough to come and work with a different assistant every day.
Now, when you started, did you have to guarantee him or her money?
I didn't with him because he understood our vision in the practice, and he wanted to build something with me.
So you graduate dental school. You have a practice. You don't want to do a certain procedure. Are you reaching out to these people and try to create this idea, or did they reach out to you?
I reached out to him. So ironically, actually, he was teaching a course, an implant course in Chicago that I took, and he mentioned kind of his model, and I went up to him and I said, I want to hire you.
Because I think there is an indispensable value for a new graduate or new dentist who's trying to.
You keep going. I'm sorry. Well, there's something that
you're
he
not
just,
that sorry, though.
No, I'm not. You're right. I'm not.
So besides him, I think there's an indispensable value in that. If you could have somebody early on in your career come in and do those procedures, you're still making money off that. You're paying good money to do it. They're getting done in your office. You're getting to learn on the, I mean, how awesome would that be to be like, okay, well, I'm not doing something. I can watch them do third molars. I can watch them place an implant. I can watch them do root canal.
I mean, there's a lot of
And you're making money on that. And that to me is a no-brainer to reach out and look for that.
It's not even just about the money for the procedure. I think it's just case acceptance. I mean, we do a lot of implants. We do a lot of, you know, implants are technically elective surgery, right? No one's going to die without an implant. And when you refer them to another office, they're much less likely to follow through because that's a barrier. That's another process they have to go through. But if it's all done here and my front office and treatment coordinators can give them a treatment estimate right in the office, schedule them with the surgeon, there's less likely a chance for them to decline treatment. So we end up doing a lot more cases. The patients get treated. They're happier. They're getting the dentistry that they want.
Mina, for these surgical cases, are you finding it to be a barrier for your surgeon to have never met the patient before?
No, because there's a consult process that we've worked together. So I understand his treatment philosophies and I can essentially do the consult for him. So, and I introduce him always as the surgeon, you know, Dr. Ignato is going to come in and take care of the procedure for you today. And there's not a need for a lot of rapport. He can, you know, manage that initially.
Well, if your patients trust you, they're going to trust the guy you're bringing in, right? Like they're going to. All right. T-Bone's raising his hand. Dr. Agarwal, what would you like to add?
I would like to point out to the audience that what Mina said was he went up to this person and said, I would like to hire you. He did not wait for that person to come to him. Okay. He created instead of waiting for it to just happen. So again, my lesson on that, on a lot of things right now is about creating what it is you want. Don't wait for it to come to you. Just create it. And sometimes you're going to fall. Sometimes it's not going to work, but you learn so much along the way.
That's a pitfall for a lot of our new dentists, because they've grown up in a world where they didn't have to go after it like that. And so that's a big take home point. You know, there's a lot of ability out there and a lot of resources out there, but you got to run after it and you can be really successful right now. I mean, dentistry, I think all of us would, you know, we couldn't agree. I mean, we couldn't be more happy to be doing what we're doing. But there's a lot of dentists right now who are like miserable and like, are not excited about the future of dentistry. But so much of that is like how you make it. And none of us are waiting for that, it to come to us like that. You know, we're running out for what we want.
Well, it turns out I found out this weekend that I actually have been waiting for it to come to me to a certain degree, and that's going to stop.
Yeah. So Mina, let me ask you this, back to the thing. When is a practice ready to bring in a specialist?
Right now.
I'm a startup 6 months in.
Right now. Because you have patients walking out your door.
I can barely pay myself and my team members.
This isn't going to cost you anything. This is a percentage of collections. It's a scalable procedure.
Okay. So technically what you're saying is like an associate, essentially.
Correct.
With no, you're saying you're able to oftentimes get somebody with no minimal guarantee. Okay. But you have to have some level of patient base. So, okay, I get that. I get what you're saying is that in theory, everybody's ready right now. But what is the ideal scenario to do something like this?
I think ideally you should have at least a full day of surgeries per month to make it more regular.
So maybe 1,000 patient practice?
Yeah, closer to a full-time practice. So 1,200 patients per dentist is typically full-time. Okay. So if you can get this specialist at least a full day of cases a month, it'll make it more regular, easy to schedule, and then they can continue with their follow-up.
How many operatories do you have?
5.
Do you have this specialist work on days that it's not? Because to me, I'm thinking, man, my office, I'm paying the same rent, same overhead,
right,
and it's sitting there empty on a Friday.
So,
which is silly, by the way.
If you can have them come in on a day where you can sacrifice some of your chair time, mm-hmm, or if you don't have any chair time, that's a win-win.
Right.
You just have to provide some team members and
auxiliary
staff.
But isn't one
and,
of the challenges that everybody's day that they're not using the office is essentially the same day? Like in some big city markets, it's Wednesdays, correct? Mm-hmm. In some areas, it's Mondays. In most areas of the country, it's Friday or Saturday, correct? At some point, there's only so many specialists that you can bring in on a Friday or Saturday, or that are willing to come in.
Well,
on
part
a Friday
of that goes
Saturday.
Back to how much do you want it though? Because like,
make your,
you know, are
priority.
You are you really, yeah, making yourself available is huge. Like how much do you want it? I mean, ultimately, and I get so pissed about that because people be like, well, I don't have, you know, I'm in debt. I don't have the money to do this. I can't buy this, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, but I want to live in the city and I want to work, you know, 7:30 to 4:30, 3 days a week. Or it's like, what the heck do you think? Or you can't just do that. You know, change up your hours, do something. I mean, how easy would it be for us? I mean, you know how many oral surgeons would come into your office on Mondays? There's a ton.
So I think it's important, and it was important for me to be there when he was there. Because our model is we don't want to fill his schedule with consults that take time and aren't, you know, procedural.
That's a good point.
Let me do the consult and then let me do the handoff when the surgeon is there. We both meet the patient, we have a conversation, he does the procedure. So I gave him one of my days and all of my chairs during that day. So he has 3 of our operatories. I just do hygiene exams and he handles his surgery. And it works great. And their patients come in and they feel more comfortable. And it's not a stranger that they haven't seen before. At least there's a familiar face
there.
So
you're at the office.
I'm at the office.
But that frees you up to
Are you always at the office or maybe just your associates there?
No, I try to be there when he's there. I want her to be.
So you, when you say you, I would have clarified for the audience, you as the practice owner.
Right.
Okay.
So me as the practice owner, I try to be there when the specialist is there as well.
What are they doing?
You can work admin and stuff too. Or
yeah, I'm on Facebook usually most of the day and then just smile at patients and hang out. That's my day.
What specialist are you bringing in?
I missed out on a lot.
I have a periodontist right now. Next step is an endodontist because I don't like doing root canals. A pedodontist would be huge in my area.
So on a pedodontist, isn't that set up a practice very different from a general practice?
Completely different. We'd have to change our entire hygiene system. We'd have to change our schedule.
So that would be something you might look to do towards the end of the cycle.
I would do it now and I would make adjustments to it. My reasoning is very stupid. I just don't want little kids messing up my nice office. And it's a stupid reason, but there's a feel to an office when there's adult patients there and it's just kind of overrun with kids. It's a little bit different. So I just haven't gotten over that yet. I need to grow up a little bit on that, but
I don't know. I don't know if you do though, because I think ultimately you have to look at what your practice you want to be. Because you know when you graduate, you have an idea of, okay, I want to make X amount of dollars. How am I going to get there? Well,
but you can make X dollars without ever working. By the way,
you can, and I'm kind of going on that track though, because you know when you start to look at, okay, what percentage do you want to be hygiene revenue? What percent do you want to be, you know, your revenue? What do you want to do? Because there are some practices that it's like, okay, well, you can have 6 hygienists and you could do a lot of pro fees and like get to a higher revenue based off that. Or then there are some people who have 1 hygienist.
Or you can do one root canal that's equivalent to more than 1 hygienist.
Right. Exactly. So that's my point, is you start to say, okay, what is valuable in the practice? And we talked about a little bit this weekend about trying to move, you know, for me personally, we have to start moving our practice beyond basic dentistry. Okay. Because if we want to work less, make more money and be more successful, we have to do things that are more valuable. We can't just do a lot of pro fees and a lot of crowns.
But Soli, what Mina was saying is really important, because, and Mina, I wouldn't sell yourself short on this. You know what you want your practice to be.
Well, that was my point, right? Though.
You know, but you know what you want it to be from a philosophy standpoint. And if your practice is meant to treat adult patients with more significant issues, then
making 50 grand off kids isn't worth it.
That should be what it is. And you shouldn't make the pediatric side a priority. Now, is that something that you can provide on a day that you typically wouldn't be practicing in that office? Absolutely. That's a great use of your space, but you need to have that delineation. And I like that you have, and I wouldn't force yourself to feel bad that you're sticking to that. I think that's a good thing.
How soon do y'all think you get to be picky on that though? When do you get to decide what you want your practice to be?
From day one.
I think that's an unrealistic answer to a certain degree. I would say that I became picky when I became financially secure that my bills were going to get paid. Not financially secure for my life.
Because that's the question. Like, students are graduating and they're wondering, how the heck am I going to pay that loan payment next month?
Sure. Okay. So don't get me started on the loan payments.
Because
the
we're not going there. Okay. Well, let's just say your debt. Let's just say your debt pay, your bills. Let's just say your bills.
So when you get to a point where your practice easily produces what it takes to live a basic life, okay, that's when you can start being picky. Okay. So to me, everything was about, for me, the number was to get to 40 grand a month in production or collections, 50 grand a month in production or collections, I think it was. So that would allow me to have an income that easily paid for my life. So, and then at that point, I started becoming particular and choosing. Now, to me, the way I did that was I started making my extra days my perfect days. Okay, so when I was working 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, Fridays were my perfect days. So I transitioned myself and my practice towards what I wanted to be by adding the perfect day in. And that only happened as long as Monday through Thursday was producing enough to pay my bills. And then what happened was Friday, the perfect day, produced as much as Wednesday and Thursday combined. Okay, so that bought me the freedom to make Thursday a perfect day. Okay, or to completely cut out Thursdays, or to move Fridays to a Thursday and cut out Fridays. So to me, the key along the way is being smart about how you utilize your money, being smart about as your income grows, that your expenses don't grow with it right away, that there is a lag period between, as your income grows, there's a lag period of some significant amount of time, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, before your expenses grow with your income, so that you have that freedom and flexibility for that 1, 2, 3 years to be able to do other things.
You made a good point though. You said your simple life.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Which
right.
Like,
listen, not this life.
I drove crappy old lemon cars. I did not have a brand new car until I was 36 years old. And I used to only work two. And I was just talking tonight. I was like, do you know what my production goal used to be when I started
40,
out?
50 grand.
How much I was, well, just like on a daily basis. And
$2,000 probably.
I think it was three.
Yeah.
And then it was, now it's up a lot. I mean, it's, you know, tripled, but it's kind of crazy to think way back when I started, but everything's kind of scaled since then, but I lived simply.
But the lag point, the lag time is critically important between as your income goes up and as your expenses go up.
Well, I think there's too many, like, we want it now type mentality as well.
And if you want to be successful, you'll do that, and then it will make the world, because that's what, from a financial standpoint, if you will give yourself that sort of lag time, that allows you to take more CE, you start investing yourself. I mean, because that's ultimately what got me to be successful. Was I like, I drank the Kool-Aid, right? Like, I was like, I listen to people say, like, do this, invest in this, spend the money to do it. And like, next thing you know, it's all paying off.
Well, John had an associate that came the last course, and she was great. And she's like, hey, talk to him about, I want to do Botox in my practice. Like, talk to him about it. And she was learning sleep and wanting to do Botox. How far out of school is she?
She's just over 2 years. She was in
Sully's
2 years.
Class. Yep. 15. Yeah. So I'm 14 years out. So then I get to do those kind of things now. But when she kind of needs to get good at the regular dentistry first. And that's the point that you were making.
Yes. And I think that all of the dentists just coming out, they have to secure their home, just like T-Bone was saying. You got to secure your practice home, and you do that by getting really good and really efficient and really effective at the bread and butter dentistry. Doing quadrant dentistry with fillings is something that should just be a no-brainer.
But isn't that traditional thinking? That's how the way dentistry has always been, that the rite of passage? And who says, I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, because to a certain degree, I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, because if I say that, I'm freaking castrated for it. But if you say it, it's like,
being devil's advocate here, okay? Because that's traditional thinking. The traditional thinking is it's a rite of passage. You got to do it this way, then you'll get there.
And my thing is like, why do I have to wait? Yeah. I'll do what the heck I want to do.
That's great. And I totally agree. You know what? There's going to be that diamond in the rough that is just amazing at implant dentistry from the day they get out of school. They're going to be amazing at it the day they get into dental school. All right? There's going to be that person. There's going to be the Botox expert. There will. There's somebody right now in school or just out that is the expert in that. And that's great. And those people know when they have it because they just know it. And they're going to go do it, and they have the drive to do it. But for the 99.9% of the rest of the graduates, you do. And it's not a rite of passage. It's not we're better than you. It's not we did it, so you have to do it too. It's the way it works. You need to get good at the bread and butter dentistry, the basic stuff, so that you can have the skills to take care of high level issues, so that you can have the communication skills. You can communicate with your patients about why they need advanced procedures. You can communicate with your team why it's so important for your patients to have these advanced procedures. If you can't do MODO, MOD on a patient, like, without blinking your eyes, how are you supposed to even talk to them about replacing teeth with implants, about doing significant endodontic surgery, about doing ortho, about doing Botox and sleep? How are you supposed to do that if you can't even do a couple of fillings, like, without even thinking about it?
So my kind of, when I look back on this weekend, one of my favorite parts about this weekend was, when this is tying in, don't just laugh, I'm going off this. So was when you kind of, when you looked at us and we kind of went through stuff and you were like, when is trying to identify goals. And I think, you know, even though we're for different stuff, that was, is so impactful for all of us to do at all different types of our stages in our careers. And I would encourage people to like, to do that, to sit down and say, okay, well, whether I'm graduating or not graduating, what is the goal that I want? What do I want in my practice? What do I want to do? And then work backwards to achieve it. Because,
but the truth is, it's easy to say these things, but the problem is very, very few of us sit down and do it. We very few of us take the time to block time, to disconnect from life. In other words, turn our phones off, you know, put ourselves in a room where our kids and wives or bed partners or husbands or whatever it may be aren't around, so that way we can have freedom and we can have clarity in our thoughts, and that way we can take a hard look at where we are and where we want to be. And too often, I believe we're doing it at the wrong time of the year. I think too much planning is done in January. I think now is the time to do planning for 2018, because it allows you to see, to me, August is the best time to start planning for 2018 in this case, or the next year.
Yeah,
the next year, because what you can do is you can reflect on the first half of the year, adjust the second half of the year to allow you to really be in a position to get to your 2018 goals. But if we start planning our goals in January or December of, you know, to, for the following year, we don't have that ramp up period or that period to reflect on what we've done and make changes to allow us to re-get on path towards that goal.
Tarun, I thought it was really, at first I thought it was weird that we were sitting here talking about our goals for 2018 outside of the practice. I'm like, well, geez, why are we talking about 2018? We have more than half the year still. And then I realized it's the freaking end of August. I mean, this is like the perfect time to start doing
it.
That
is the time. It's every
the
year.
Time to do it.
Every and year in August is
as
when
I started
it.
Walking through it and what I need to do to reach those goals, it's like, wow, I'm already behind.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see, I mean, if you think you're a senior in dental school and you're, you know, finishing up stuff, you're taking boards, that sort of thing, starting to like put stuff on paper, what do you want? What do you aspire to be? Like, are you just gonna, you know, you got to start to have some sort of picture of what you want, or you're not going to be able to create it.
Well, okay. So along those lines, let's talk about, you know, let's share that from my end. I look at goal setting as three different ways. Number one, you have to have one eye on today and tomorrow. In other words, how are we going to pay our bills? What are we going to do along the way? And number two, we got to have some eyes on what's coming 2 to 6 months down the road. And our third eye has to be focused on what we want for our career. You know, that 2 to 5 year plan out. So we can't just make goals based on where we want to be in our life like 10 years from now. That's only one portion of our goal. And quite honestly, the smaller portion of our goal, you know, the vast majority of our goals should be based on today and tomorrow. The second half of our goals should be based on 2 to 6 months out. And then our last little bit of our goal, maybe 10 or 15% should be about, are those smaller parts congruent with my ultimate overall goal of reaching something. And I think too many times we have pie in the sky thinking about goal setting. Mina, do you set goals very often?
I mean,
the way we did it this weekend.
No, this weekend was very organized. It's nice to have a dedicated time to organize your thoughts. I think my goals are always kind of evolving and kind of real time. I need to sit down and write things more because it makes it more real. I used to in the beginning, and in the beginning,
but that's also why you got where you were, right?
Right. So there's kind of ebbs and flows. In the beginning of your practice, you're excited, you're motivated, you're setting your goals, you're writing everything down, and then practice starts to grow and grow and grow, and then you start, instead of working on your practice, you're working in your practice, and you're just trying to keep your head above water and just, you know, stay afloat and stay ahead of what's coming. And then you kind of forget that. So it's nice to retreat like we did this weekend and sit down and write things out.
And I think the other nice thing about doing something like this and is about doing with like-minded individuals, people that you trust and love and that love you.
So Sully.
And me.
And Donnie.
Because Tarun, wouldn't you say and I mentioned this to you, that it's kind of painful to sit there and work out these goals when you haven't done it for a while. Like it's uncomfortable a little bit because you have to actually sit there.
And I think the most uncomfortable part of it is sharing your goals.
Yep.
Because it makes you vulnerable.
It's hard.
Right. But I think that's so important to a certain degree. Like I didn't ask us to share all our goals, right? Because I think there's certain things that you should keep in yourself and you shouldn't necessarily show it to the world. But there are certain things that you do want to show to the world because you want that feedback. Like, you know, am I realistic? Am I unrealistic? Hey, is this congruent? Like some of the goals we set was, hey, I want to make X, and I'm willing to work X number of days and I want to charge out X dollars per day. And I'm like, well, the math just doesn't make sense, right? So your goals and what you're doing aren't congruent. And sometimes you just need a third party because otherwise what we do is what? We make justification for what we're doing.
Or for me, it showed me what was out there. Cause I was my own limiting factor. Cause I don't freaking know, you know, so to hear y'all and see what the potential was and to see what the trajectory, you know, to be able to sit in a room with people who are at all different points in the scale of, you know, doing what I want to do is pretty empowering, you know, and to hear how they've gotten there and what they've done has a pretty direct impact.
Don't worry, Mama was working while you were doing all of that.
Oh,
I missed out.
Actually, Daddy did a root canal. Daddy texted me saying he did a root canal.
Oh, your daddy did root canals.
It looked quite good, actually.
It
made me. How old is your dad?
I was teaching.
It's like 54.
54?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, he made me feel bad. I'm like, dude, a 54-year-old's doing good ass endo, man.
There you go.
I'm like, God, he's got a puff and everything.
He's paying for ice cream.
You know what, though? It felt
and
so,
t-shirts.
It felt really good to get some of those goals out because they're things that I've been struggling with myself, and to say it in front of people felt really good. And so that's something I think we can all do and we should all do, whether it's professionally, personally, whatever the situation is, we need to do that.
Well, you said it makes you vulnerable, but I think it also helps you hold me accountable and vice versa. Yeah. Because now, you know, in 6 months, if we meet again, hey, where are we at? You know, you wrote this stuff down. Let's see
what
you're
doing. Not if we meet again. We schedule something.
Yeah, I know. But yeah. When we meet again.
I think for people December too, 9, like 10. There's a level of transparency with your practices that like, I think one thing that's great that you can do is have goals for your practice that you make very apparent to your team members so that they can track, you know, the fact that you want to do this, you want to produce this, you want to collect this, you want to get this involved. And so that your team's on board with the idea that you have goals for yourself as a practice that you're going
to
do.
You guys need to tell them where we went. The beef.
We went to the beef eater.
Master.
So I took everybody to this place called the Beef Master Inn.
Spelled wrong.
Mastor.
Mastor.
Beef Mastor Inn. B-E-E-F. Mastor. M-A-S-T-O-R-N. In Wilson, North Carolina. It's about a 50-minute drive from our home here
on
in Raleigh,
bus.
North Carolina. I took us on a bus. Because certainly we weren't going to let us drive, okay?
No,
and by the way, not. Wasn't that a great way to go? Because now we can actually, because legally we can drink in the bus because it's a private transportation commercially licensed, okay? Well, I had a couple of beers on the way down.
Like,
and a couple.
Like
and
three-quarters one.
No, I had two. I had two beers, plain and simple.
Whoa.
Having a great time.
And then I fell asleep on the way back, okay?
Not until we got the good news.
Not alcohol
we
news.
Snoring, at least we couldn't hear it.
At least you couldn't hear it, right? And then we get to the Beef Master Inn, and I didn't tell you guys where we were going, what we were doing. Hutan had some of an idea because Lori told him. And then you get there, and then you have to put your name on the list. And we had to wait 45 minutes, I think it was.
Is that
and
all?
And we tailgated in the parking lot.
Which is what you do there.
With those mosquitoes that were just massive and mean.
And by
they
the
were
way, this
not mosquitoes.
This restaurant was not a restaurant. It was somebody's old cinder block home.
Yep.
That couldn't have been more than 2,000 square feet.
If that.
And there were no menu.
There were 10 tables.
There's absolutely zero menu. The guy, when they come in, you sit down and he brings over a slab of a ribeye. That's all they serve is ribeye. And they go, how big?
How big?
How big? It starts
10.
It starts at 8 ounces and goes up from there. Okay. And
that was unbelievable. He literally
12,
was like,
you're like 16. 20
ounces, okay. Well, how about you? 15, 16 ounces, all right? 10 ounces.
10.
That was insane.
And they cut your ribeye right in front of you, and then they go grill it, no oven.
On one single grill.
On one single grill for the whole restaurant. They grill it, and then they bring it back to you. And
baked potato.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
And a salad bar with a sneeze guard.
But
I appreciate the sneeze guard.
Salad bar wasn't bad.
And I know Mina appreciated the sneeze guard.
I loved every part of it.
But listen, I think this is what is common about most modern day successful people is they get in front of other people and they don't hide or keep from their colleagues. They actually get together and share. And it's not about whether it costs money or doesn't cost money, because you can do this for free in your area. And it doesn't have to be with just dentists. You can do this with other professionals in your area or other small business owners in your area, because a business is a business, whether it's a dental office, a veterinary office, or a carpet store.
But Tarun, I got to say, I think what was a major help, see if the other people agree, a number of us, except for maybe Sully, we were friends.
Yeah. But we were, but
except
but again,
for Sully.
Thanks, you Dan.
But my point in that is, where are we friends from? Not dental school. Did any of us go to dental school together? Did any of us?
No, no. I get what you're saying. What I meant was, it wasn't like cold turkey. Like it wasn't like I reached out to another business owner.
No, because then everybody wouldn't be the same way
in my community.
But
it was like
at the same time, though, that's kind of what I did.
No, you were incredible. You.
That's why
you're
gregarious.
You're outgoing. That's you. You know what I mean? Some people put in that same situation would not have handled it the way you did. They would have been maybe a little bit more reserved, a little bit more sheltered. At least for myself, I don't know about these two, but because I've known most of these guys for years, Johnny P, I really got to meet. We were always on like conference calls and whatever for various speaking events, but I actually got to meet him last November at an Ivoclar event. And then we went out and kind of did like a bonding session that night after everybody went out. We got back like 3-4 in the morning, but that sealed the deal.
And I think my flight left O'Hare at 6 a.m.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep. So, yeah. So, we all kind of knew each other. So, I thought that made it easy, right? You know, Dennis for a few years, Eric for a few years, you know, all these guys. So, that's how I felt. I don't know if I didn't have that connection with these guys. I don't know if it would have went that way. No. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Night, Hooten.
I would say at this point, though, that I would consider you totally in the friend status, bro.
Wow. Huge.
Bro, that's fine.
Huge.
End of the day.
By the way, Peter's passed out half naked on the bed upstairs.
Let's all go to bed.
He's not in my room.
Perfect. It's warm.
Sweet.
This has been good.
It's all good.
Heck of a weekend.
I'll see you up there.
Glad you came back for the Sleep 101 course. And
it's
got
a great course.
And got to do this instead.
And you brought a team member.
And my team member, my sleep champion, is now going to be a real champion. She loved the course. You know, I think there's a lot of value. It was, you know, I know you want people to bring the proof, but it was a value for her because she had experienced it from me, but then got to experience it totally different way with
but then she experienced it for
well,
real.
Each course is so different, honestly.
But she experienced it for real. She didn't experience it from you.
You can't. Yeah, it's just different.
Thank you.
Rock out.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.